Alrighty, so supposedly this is supposed to be about statistical parameterizations of something, this particular lunchtime thing. So I will actually say something about statistical parameterizations towards the end. In other words, I think we can do it. But the whole rest of the talk will have nothing to do with that subject. So I'd like to tell you a little bit about myself. I got interested in the problems that I'm going to be telling you about today as a byproduct of being an undergraduate with Ray Pierre Humbert, who many of you either know or met last week. And starting off then, essentially reading this paper and other papers associated with it from the late 80s and early 90s, I became interested in past climates. So let me just walk you through the nature of the problem shown on this graph. So this is an attempt to estimate temperatures at the surface of the ocean about 50 million years ago. And there is actually a 3-hour long talk that I give where I go into all the details of how you estimate paleoclimates. And I realized that would be a very long lunch. I'd be happy to give another talk where I talk about more of the details of paleoclimate, but in this case, I'm just going to have to assume that you'll believe me when I say we do this, and there are error bars, and I'm happy to discuss them. And actually, that's part of the point of this talk. But as of 1987, and really this data is coming from 1981, as of 1987, it was understood that this period in Earth's past was really quite warm at the poles, so you know, significantly above 273 or freezing. And the thought at the time was that the tropics were actually, in this paper, if anything, a little bit cooler than they are today, which is sort of an interesting idea, and that was noted originally by Shackleton and Boersma in 1981. And it was really Eric Barron, among other people, but mostly Eric, who kind of said, hey, this is really very interesting and odd, because it's really hard to come up with a means to transport more heat polewards as the temperature gradient decreases. And almost any kind of system that you want to think about, transport increases as the gradient increases, not the other way around. So he poses a sort of an interesting and fundamental problem, and a lot of people have been working on it now for decades. So let me just...
Isn't that just the dog and the chair? I mean, if you have more transport, you have less gradient.
Right. So absolutely. But in some sort of statistical steady state, it's hard to imagine how to get there. We understand our world pretty well, where we have strong transports, or what we like to think of as strong, and strong gradients. And anything that looks, you know, any kind of operator that looks anything like diffusion would make, or you know, even if you go to higher order operators, but anything looks, that makes this kind of look kind of odd. It doesn't mean you can't explain it, but just you have to work at it. And of course, there's always radiation. Yeah.
For those of us who don't think about paleoclimate too much, can you put the Eocene into the big picture?
Yeah, I will. So this is about 50 million years ago. This is, the dinosaurs died at 65 million years ago. I'll show you some paleogeographic maps. But essentially, the continents didn't look too much different than they do today, but there were some important continental position changes that I'll show you in a minute. But you can look at this. This is zonal mean, right? So this is the northern hemisphere. This is the southern hemisphere, and we just averaged along the latitude line. And at the time, this is basically all the data points that we had, and they suggested maybe that the tropics were, if anything, a little cooler than today, and the poles were something like 20 degrees warmer. It's an interesting problem. And I'll, you know, just to give you an indication of where we're going, we no longer believe that those tropical data points are correct, and there's many good reasons for revising them upwards. And much of what I'll show you later involves revising these tropical temperatures upwards. But the polar temperatures, yeah, these are pretty solid results. We've revised these a bit over the years, but that part of the problem hasn't changed too much. So like I said, I'm going to try not to go too much into depth, but in this case, it's from the oxygen isotopic composition of planktonic foraminifera. So you have little plankton that live in the ocean, and they make up their shells out of calcium carbonate. And as they take up some of the seawater, there's a fractionation due to the difference in weight.
Then you interpolate the surface because it floats surface then.
Right, so these things are living, say, in the upper, usually, maybe not in this figure, but in the later ones, usually in the mixed layer. And being a well-mixed layer, we can have an estimate of the surface temperature. But there's certainly the opportunity for a bias on the order of a couple of degrees. If anybody wants to add 3 degrees to everything here, that would actually be the least of my worries.
This is always compared to the sort of standard mean ocean waters.
Right, so
this is before glacial times, so we don't know how much is at land.
You could actually estimate during this time. So there's a global mean value, and it's like -1.2 per mil. We don't need to worry about that. What matters here, and part of the reason why these data points were put upwards, is the spatial gradients in seawater delta 18L. So, and that is indeed why when Jim Zachos kind of corrected for these things, these temperatures went up a bit. And again, I really could spend 2 hours on that, but I'll show you more recent work that kind of should give you a better idea of what we now think the reality is. What I find much more interesting and much more convincing is when I look at qualitative proxies, and this is what the geography looked like about 50 million years ago, and I just want you to note the giant red crocodiles, okay? And, you know, I don't really care too much, actually, about oxygen isotopic compositions and all the details. I'm really pretty sure that when you find a palm tree in the coast of Alaska and a crocodile off the coast of Greenland, that it was warm at the poles. And
they had elephants
here. Right. You know, I spent a lot of time in graduate school trying to think, could a tornado have lifted the crocodile up and transported it? Maybe did they migrate? I mean, really, I got to say that, you know, I started working on this when I was 19, and I spent about 10 years of my life really trying to think about how to explain away the crocodiles, and it's really difficult. Maybe you could explain away the crocodiles, but then there's 30 other proxies that would all tell you it was warm at the poles. So I just, you know, again, we can look at the details, but, you know, maybe you don't really need to. I think it's very clear it's warm at the poles. The tropical temperatures are going to be the thing we kind of always come back to and say this is actually the main uncertainty. Also keep in mind that half the surface area of the planet is between 30 north and 30 south. So tropical temperatures really are going to dominate any kind of global mean temperature change estimate. And you'll also note there's far more data in some regions than in others. And there's some data points here in the tropics, but there's large data gaps also. So again, just to reiterate how interesting the poles were, these are from Jane Francis. If you go up to Ellesmere Island, which is more or less at 81 or 82 degrees north today, you can actually find, in these cases, they're slightly fossilized tree stumps. There are actually unfossilized, mummified tree stumps that are, let me just have that up there for a minute. And in this case, these are about 45 million years old. Okay, so there were forests on, well, the north slope of Alaska, Ellesmere Island, all these places near Greenland during these periods of time. And you can estimate the biomass. And there was, you know, big whomping forests. In this case, this is probably metasequoia. And those aren't too temperature tolerant. They don't grow in these regions today. But these don't require above freezing temperatures, whereas crocodilians and other like palm trees do require above freezing temperatures all year round. But this was sort of a large temperate forest up there at high latitudes. Well, you can actually go and you can see tree rings and what I skipped the picture of. You can actually go up there and there's unfossilized, just sort of mummified branches and twigs. And it actually, I know a group of people who were up there for their summer field season, and the plane, or no, helicopter, or was it a plane? I don't know. It took off. Whatever was dropping them off there took off. And that's when they realized their heating oil for the summer was on that vehicle. And they ended up actually having to burn some of the 45 million year old perfectly mummified trees, which didn't make them popular back home with the paleontologists. But so, you know, I'll just say, you know, these really are absolutely trees and plants, and we actually know a lot about them. You can identify them down to almost the species level.
Can I just ask one question?
Yeah.
Could you say something about these age dates are fairly crucial. At each point when you give us a number, could you just give me some idea of where that date comes from? For example, these stumps, 45 million years old, is that some sort of isotopic analysis?
Yeah, it's bracketed by isotopic analysis. So actually, the age uncertainty varies depending on what I'm talking to you about. The age uncertainty on these is actually fairly large. It's something like 5 million years. And actually, people have argued for a long period of time about exactly how old these are. We think we actually have them nailed, but yeah, it's basically, argon on one side and something else, and then there's biostratigraphy in between. But it's not, these in particular, it's actually hard to get a good date because this, for example, this kind of tree in this ecosystem persists from about 60 million years to about 45 with only brief major changes. And the number of dates are, hard, isotopically derived dates is a little bit, it's only like three. And you have to correlate from the sections where you do have good dates to ones where you don't have good dates. So there's like two dates in the Eureka Formation, which is nearby this. In terms of dates, this is actually probably the one with the biggest error bars that I will show you the whole time. So in general, it was a very warm world, and both the biology and the carbon cycle and presumably the hydrological cycle were interesting and different in interesting ways. And superimposed on this generally warm world, there was a brief event which Ray and some other people, including maybe me, kept harping about at the meeting last week, the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum, which is a very abrupt warming event associated with a major perturbation of the carbon cycle at essentially 55.5 million years ago. And we now have evidence of this event from the tropical Pacific all the way to the North Pole and the Southern Ocean. So, I mean, it's a global event. The temporal resolution we have on the records tends to be extremely good. It's on the order of 100,000 years, and you can argue about whether it's 100 or 200,000, depending on details. But the way it shows up is this is time going this way, starting at about 55.5 million years ago. This is a number of records, in this case from the equatorial Pacific, and temperature warms. We pick this as a peak value by about 5 degrees, maybe 4 degrees, depending on how you pass your eye through this. And this data is from magnesium calcium. This is from the delta 18O of Foraminifera. There's a little bit of a difference. We tend to believe, because of these other kind of countervailing issues, we tend to believe magnesium calcium better. But anyway, it shows about a 5 degree warming and then a return gradually to pre.
What's the time scale?
So this is about, so this is 100,000 years, 150,000 years, something like that. This is actually two records from the Arctic Ocean, from the ASEX cruise that actually went up to the Arctic and basically by dumb luck managed to pull out almost I won't call it a continuous section. It's amazing that they have as few core breaks as they do, given what happened on the ship. But this is essentially, by looking at the carbon isotopes, we know this is the exact same interval in time, and this is temperature along the bottom axis. This is two different proxies. This is two different proxies in this case, organic proxies and not from carbonate. And they show, these are totally independent. This is TEX-86, which is derived from things that live in the ocean, and this is from bacteria that live on the land, hypothetically near the ocean, and they both show the exact same. If their core breaks here, that's what the missing data is. They show the exact same trend and essentially the same magnitude within a degree or two. So from this point of view, and there's 30 records I could show. This is just two of them. Okay. So from this point of view, it's really interesting. Look, the temperature of the Arctic Ocean, even before this really, really, really warm interval, is something like 18 degrees C. And it goes up to something like 23 or 24. and then it goes back down to something like 18. Okay? And so there's a lot of, for a dynamicist, there's a lot of interesting things here. First of all, it's so warm down here. Another thing is the warming in low latitudes and high latitudes is almost the same. Usually we expect to see strong amplification of warming. Here the amplification is dubious at best, and probably there's no good reason to think we see any at all. And the time scales are interesting. So it was warm for 100,000, 150,000 years, something like that. And of course, just remember, this is all happening in a world that's already extremely warm. This is way too warm for there have been sea ice or other forms of ice, perennial ice on the planet. Antarctica hadn't glaciated yet. Greenland hadn't, there were no glaciers there, right? So it's actually very interesting. How do you warm the planet by about 5 degrees in a world that's already pretty warm? You don't get a lot of the strong feedbacks that most of us associate with say, ice albedo. There are other feedbacks that could kick in, and that's why this is really interesting. This may help us get a grip on some of the other feedbacks that sometimes are dwarfed by ice albedo. If you were to, I didn't show an actual absolute temperature here, but if you were and you were to use magnesium calcium, you would pick out a temperature of something like 37 degrees here for the central equatorial Pacific. So not 25 or 26 or 27 or 28 or any of the numbers that people have been wanting to throw around for the past 20 years, but really almost 10 degrees warmer than the kind of number that people usually talk about. So anyway, we published a bunch of papers on this. And again, I don't have time to go into it other than to say that from these records in the Arctic Ocean, it's really nice. We have carbon isotopes, we have deuterium isotopes, and we have other records, including qualitative ones that tell us something about the hydrological balance of the Arctic. And what actually the deuterium and the qualitative indicators, in this case, dinoflagellate cysts. Dinoflagellates, in this case, these are species that really like fresh water, and so we can say how many of these relatively fresh water species there were. And what you pull out is that in the height of the warming, there's actually a lot of dinoflagellates that kind of like relatively fresh water. And you lose a lot of those in other parts of the record. And then you gain them back again in others. A little bit complex. But we derived from that there were changes in the hydrological cycle during this warming interval, which led to an increase in net precipitation at high latitudes, which kind of agrees with what various people think about how global warming works, if there's an increase in the latent heat transport. And the data is too sparse and sketchy, and I mean, it makes a good Nature paper, but you know, is it science? It's good for focusing us on interesting problems, but it's far from proving anything, right? So you know, this kind of laid out the beginning of probably 20 years more work, more than anything. And at least demonstrated we could do some of these things. So this is a compilation put together of what the temperature anomaly during this really, really warm event is. This is put together by Jim Zakos. If I did this compilation, I might have numbers that were off by 1 or 2 degrees from his numbers, but they're generally right. So about a 5 degree warming near the equatorial Pacific. There's about, depending on what proxy you use, about an 8 degree warming off the coast here, 5 or 6 degree warming in the Arctic Ocean. This is the only one that I would really disagree with Jim. When I look through, this is from the Kennett and Stott record in the Southern Ocean. When I look through it, I by eyeball, I would say 6. Jim says 9. Whatever, we can disagree on that. Depends on whether you pick the extreme values or not. From the South Atlantic, we get about a 5 degree warming. I also want you to note that in terms of absolute temperatures, how warm this is. There's only 3 absolute temperatures, or 4 absolute temperatures. 37 here from Tanzania, and I'll talk more about that. About 33 from the coast of New Jersey, 28 or so from the coast of California, about 20 here in the Southern Ocean. I mean, you know, it's hot, right? I just.
Why do you see this thin red stripe like along South America?
It's on the land, along the
mountain range.
Oh, because it gets heat from the ocean and.
No, this is just this is topography.
So red is colder.
Yes.
Oh, it's not temperature.
No, sorry. No, the numbers are temperature. Remember, we have so little information. We don't make maps. You know, I'll show you from the modeling we can make maps. But this, you know, there's like 10 data points on this whole map.
When you quote these temperatures, do you think of them as seasonally average, day average, or how do you think about that?
That gets into the whole issue of what the biases might be. For example, this one, if it's TEX-86, there's reasons to expect that it might, at high latitudes, it might be seasonally biased towards the summer or the spring. On the other hand, you get the exact same numbers with MBT in the same core, which we don't expect to be biased in that direction. So maybe it's not biased, it's hard to say. But I can constrain that. That introduces about a 5-degree temperature bias. So maybe this is not 20, but maybe it's 15. So it doesn't, you know, it's still bloody hot, right? Most of these, it's probably reasonable to expect that they are mean annual, but mean annual at some depth, perhaps averaging over the upper 50 meters or something. None of that affects the relative change, because we expect them, although one could argue that it's not true that they always live at the same paleo depth, roughly. Is this biased in some way? If it is, again, it's the tropics. It's hard to bias it seasonally. This probably really is, in this case, surface temperature mean annual. But on the other hand, if you look at the calibration for this particular proxy, you see that it has errors on the order of 3 or 4 degrees in some region for unknown reasons. So, you know, you should absolutely always put kind of like a plus or minus 3 degrees on anything that I'm showing you. I think that would be a very reasonable thing to do.
It would be anything like the polar bear probably didn't exist at the time.
Right. Actually, the polar bear is extremely young. It's less than a million years old.
Yeah.
Which is why I really don't care if it dies.
Are there species that we have to look for that sort of live through these warm periods?
Sure.
Which are really requiring cold temperatures?
Oh, things that require cold? Now, when this is actually a major problem in terrestrial evolution that people have been looking at for 60 years, there are things that we commonly associate with cold temperatures today. And whenever you look back in the past, they're just coexisting quite happily with things that we usually think of as being really hot temperatures. And there's multiple interpretations of that, but the simplest one is things, you know, maybe there are things that can outcompete other organisms at cold temperatures, but that doesn't mean that they are required to live in cold temperatures. That's actually very, I'm not aware of anything that we can think of that's required to live in cold temperatures.
What was the solar flux at that time?
Solar flux, so there's orbital permutations in solar flux, but we can ignore that for the moment. But in terms of just sort of the mean solar flux, if you believe the trajectory of, you know, the people who work on solar physics give us, at most, the difference is about a watt per meter squared. So it might have been 1 watt per meter squared less than today.
So it was not forced by the sun.
It was not forced by the sun.
It's internal heat
system. Oh, it's not internal heat. One of the simple arguments would be that it's a greenhouse effect or something else. Right? And we'll get into that. That's hopefully what I'll spend the majority of this talk on. Right, so I gave this talk at MIT and it took 3 hours. Talk at Yale took 3 hours. This talk at Texas A&M, it only took an hour and a half, but they already knew all the paleo climate. So there's a lot of different hypotheses that have been advanced over the years to explain these various features. One of the oldest ones is that ocean heat transport was much higher in the past because the configuration of the continents was different, and so therefore the high latitudes were kept warmer in this case because some of the major land masses were connected to high latitudes, and so a warm western boundary current could penetrate the high latitudes. An old argument. Some people have speculated that atmospheric heat transport was greater for various reasons. It could be a permanent El Nino, which I don't particularly think is relevant, but it might be increased latent heat transport, but you then have to explain why there was increased latent heat transport, in which case you probably have to invoke higher CO2. People have worked on other things, including polar stratospheric clouds, and I've done some of that work, and that's a non-starter. It's always important to keep in mind that vegetation is an important part of this, but really nobody's managed to make a lot of hay with this one. I'm actually going to, since I've worked actually, I think, on all of these, I'm going to concentrate on the ones that I know are important or not important. We're really pretty sure CO2 is higher. This is one particular proxy for PCO2. I happen to think it's pretty good, but I also think it probably has factor of two potential errors in it and some timing problems. This is from Mark Pagani, and this is based on alkenones. So what's interesting about this record is that, so modern day partial pressure of CO2 in the atmosphere is in this range here. So what's interesting about this record is it shows sort of near modern day values going all the way back to about 20 some odd million years ago. And then a little bit of an increase here, but then a larger increase here, and then a big increase as you go further back in time to the Eocene, the time period of relevance here. And in fact, this figure, well, you could tell it was published in Nature and Science because it was wrong, because there's a hiatus here, and there shouldn't actually be any data here. The whole thing is displaced over. But you're talking about probably conservatively about 1,200 parts per million, plus or minus, again, kind of a factor of two, if you will. And you're not even getting to the really warm parts of the Eocene. The really warm parts, the parts I care about, are out here 50, 55 million years ago. And actually, we have virtually no CO2 information from that period of time. There are other proxies I could show. Lowenstein and D'Amico would be one data set that would actually more or less concur with this one. I think it's the simplest thing to remember is that probably, and I could cite a study or two by well-known, very good people that would disagree with me, but probably CO2 was sort of below doubling, below 560 ppm or so, through much of the past 30 million years, and largely above that number for from 35 million years to 55 or 60 million years. Now, how much higher, actually, that depends on what proxy. but probably that's the case. So we have very good reason to think that at least the first order, there are changes in CO2. Now, how big they are, I think, is debatable. And the exact timing is also debatable. This curve is about to change substantially. I'm working with Mark and his postdocs and with that group. And this change, the basic shape is the same, but the details are all changing. So if you make some simple assumptions and you put that level of CO2 into a global climate model, and that climate model makes a couple of assumptions itself. In this case, we assume modern-day ocean heat transport. But we move the continents around, we change the vegetation, we change the mountain ranges, we do everything else that we can. And then we compare the model to the proxies. You end up with a graph that looks like this from Shelito et al. 2003. These lines are model results for mean annual temperature from three different simulations of different CO2, going from doubling to tripling to quadrupling CO2. And these little data points are paleoclimate proxies for temperature. And what you see is that at, say, 60 degrees north or so, a model, even with high CO2, is still way too cold compared to the data, whereas we're already kind of pushing the upper limits, at least in this data set, of tropical temperatures.
What was the CO2 level for that?
The top curve is 2,000 ppm. Right. So, and
just a question about that.
Yeah.
So, I just want to understand this. So, you've doubled CO2 what, four times or something? In that, to go to 2,000.
So
relative to pre-anthropogenic.
It's two doubles.
5, 60, 10, three times.
well...
From 280 to 2,000,
yes.
Just...
To 2,000, yes, about 3 times.
So threefold, so that's 12 watts per square meter, and you get a roughly a 2 degree increase in tropical temperatures.
Yeah.
So how is that possible? What's the sensitivity?
The sensitivity of this particular model is on the order of 2 degrees, which actually, you know, so for kind of modern conditions, it's about 2 degrees, and you get actually basically
for double here.
Yeah, for double.
And you change it 7 times. So
no, it's three doublings.
Just
three doublings. So we would expect about a 6 degree increase, and that's actually more or less exactly.
Well, no, tropical temperature. You should be at about 28 at the equator for modern. In other words, relative to, that would be your comparison point.
It's about 6 degrees more, it works out, doesn't it?
Sorry?
It's about 6 degrees more.
Maybe I misunderstood. Can you explain the three lines in that figure one?
Sure. So it should be 5, 60, 11, 20, and 2,000 ppm.
Okay.
And the difference is so small.
Yeah.
The difference is not as small as it looks.
It's 2 degrees.
It's 2 degrees. Yeah. I mean, it's getting up to 32, and it starts off at 28, more or less.
The scale of plotting is still compact.
Sure.
More highlighted.
Your Tanzanian point does not on this subject?
The Tanzanian came after this. This is a Tanzanian data point, but the subsequent Tanzanian data. I'll show you the data, how it looks now.
Sorry, Matt, is this a model with ice at the poles?
This is a model with thermodynamic sea ice. So there's no advection of sea ice, but it does develop. this simulation is lots of sea ice. Yes, absolutely lots of sea ice. In January, this is how it looks. And these are some cold month mean proxies, which frankly, I wouldn't interpret that way. When I looked at all this with one of my simulations, I plotted up the data as I could for mean annual temperature. And I realized, you know what's interesting? This is the one-to-one line of my model compared to the proxies. And actually, the slope is similar, but I realized I was offset by about 10 degrees. And that was with 560 parts per million. So I decided, and this was basically 2001 when I decided this, I decided that my CO2 was off by an amount that should give me 10 degrees. In other words, my CO2 was off in my model, if I wanted to get things right, by on the order of 4 doublings.
That looks like astrophysics.
and so that was an unpleasant notion for many reasons. So I decided not to pursue it in 2001, but I pursued it later. So we'll get back to that. So, but that was all assuming that the heat transport was modern day. So that was actually the point of my dissertation, was to spend 4 years of my life folding in a fully dynamic ocean model, including all the effects of how the currents could change and blah, 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 and nothing changed. Or not nothing, but very, very little meaningful change. So the blue lines are how the model I was using, CCSM version 1.4, produced modern day ocean heat transport, where positive values mean transport towards the northern hemisphere, negative values are transport to the southern hemisphere. So these are all the blue lines. And what you can't really see, these little gray dashed lines are modern day observations with error bars all of their own. And you can see the modern-day model does a pretty good job of reproducing the modern observations. That's nice. We kind of knew that. And then I ran a whole set of experiments varying various things, but all with Eocene boundary conditions. And I ended up with these yellow and orange lines. So what I was really hoping for was just like those yellow and orange lines would kind of be like way, you know, big, right? But instead, what I got was Eocene boundary conditions decrease heat transported to the northern hemisphere by about 0.6 petawatts, which is exactly actually what Robbie Togweiler gets. So that should make him happy, but it really didn't. And about 0.6 petawatts more into the southern hemisphere, the total ocean heat transport doesn't change. And all of this is essentially happening in the subtropical gyres. If you look out towards the pole, where this stuff really matters, hypothetically, there's no important changes. Now I can calculate using a fixed sea surface temperature distribution that looks like the data, the amount of heat transport that my ocean should require or should be able to produce in order to maintain a small equator to pole temperature gradient. And it's that gray line. So when I say I see small changes, I mean it's small changes compared to, I see kind of half a petawatt changes, I need like 2 petawatt type changes. So in that sense, my PhD was an utter failure, and I made a lot of people unhappy with me because I said ocean heat transport didn't change much.
But how long did you run the model?
Well, in this case, I used an accelerated iterative spin-up procedure. So
you did it.
Yeah. So, but at least one of these cases was run synchronously for 1,500 years. And I'll just tell you that I now have 5 other simulations with CCSM3 that I did not accelerate or do anything to, and they're out between 3,000 and 4,000 years, and I get the exact same result.
You can change it. Ocean heat transport for 2 reasons. It's entirely wind-driven, and so it's related to the Ekman stresses, which are in turn related to strength of the nucleus. Then you need to multiply that by a stratification, which is basically given by the equator to subtropical temperature gradient, which will decrease.
That is definitely one theoretical framework. There are more than one. And if Raf Ferrari was in the room or Carl Wunsch, they would tell you why what you just said.
Just what I said for sure, because we've been working on this. There's nothing else for the subtropics really.
Well, no, not the subtropics, but high latitudes, the situation is different.
Yeah, but you can't get very much there.
And I agree with you, okay? Nevertheless, I would say that there's a large part of the community that has a different framework. And I also think they're wrong. Right.
No sound, no network.
Sure. Well, as I move farther along, I will answer, I think, all of your questions.
Just in this case, I'm curious why the northern sphere heat transfer was reduced, southern sphere increased. It's because of the continental geography?
Yeah, NADW drops by a factor of 4. And Antarctica is connected to Australia, Drake Passage. So essentially, this change is the so-called Drake Passage effect. The Drake Passage effect is real,
it's not Atlantic.
And it's unimportant for climate.
Atlantic.
Okay.
It's the Atlantic part.
Yeah.
So
you're getting rid of the heat piracy. So you're getting rid of the transport asymmetry.
So I'm going to assume then that when you have stronger transport in the southern hemisphere, you're getting stronger or poleward intensified winds in the southern hemisphere. Is that right, or is this all? Are you saying it's buoyancy problems?
This has to do with the gyres spin up to be stronger. So if you just look at the spur drift transport, it's stronger. But the key thing is that it can actually penetrate southwards a little bit better and northwards a little bit better. Because of the closed gateway, so you have western boundary currents as opposed to an ECC.
So it's a closed gateway?
Yeah, so in my Eocene cases, the southern gateways are closed.
You have reduced transport, okay, and then it's closed, right? Okay. So it doesn't really matter what you're saying it doesn't really matter what the high latitude winds are for the southern hemisphere.
Right. And so I worked with Duran Knopf, who really focuses on that stuff, specifically the wind-driven transport, and specifically at high latitudes. And we worked out the Ekman transport and the island rule, and we did all that. And actually, all the wind changes at high latitudes are of second-order importance, which is surprising because people always say katabatic winds and these other things are important. And really, actually, I don't have any of that, and it's not important. I just want to give you something that's very exciting from a data point of view. From data point of view, probably much of what we've thought about large parts of the ocean is just wrong in the past. So this is going from about 60 million years up to 40 million years. And there's a classic record that really got the entire field going from Shackleton and Kennett. This would be the benthic Delta 18 record from Shackleton and Kent. This is the planktonic record. And this record showed, it's really an amazing pioneering record, and it showed a lot of important aspects of the climate system that we still work on today. namely that the deep oceans were warm, and also later, higher up in the record, it showed a major isotopic event that we now know is the initiation of Antarctic glaciation. But there's another part of that record, that was the benthic record, which is still robustly interpreted, but the planktonic record, in other words, the record reflecting surface conditions, there was a very little gradient in temperature between the deeper ocean conditions and surface conditions. And really a lot has been made about that over the years. And what I want to tell you now is that's probably just wrong. This is a set of records from the New Zealand area in the past. This is by, you know, I listed the various people involved in this up there. New Zealand was at about between 60 and 65 degrees south latitude during this time interval, so very high latitude. And it was very near the location of this site, which is site 277. It's within about 5 degrees of that site. So from a series of records from New Zealand, from multi-proxies from TEX-86, which is totally unrelated to Delta-18O, from magnesium-calcium, which again is more or less unrelated, and also from Delta-18O, we now know that the temperatures in the surface of these regions were not what this would indicate, in other words, 22 degrees C, but like 35.
Even where? Tropics?
No, 65 degrees south. Okay? And ordinarily I would say this is crazy, but we have three different proxies that you probably can't see it, but these are three different proxies all giving you the same answer. And plus, if you look at species that don't live near the surface, you can actually see the full range of values between the benthic values and the surface values. So we think this is all real. That says two very interesting things. The temperature gradient between at least this part of the high latitudes and the deep ocean was on the order of 20 degrees C and not 4, which is basically how most people have been thinking about this problem for 30 years.
That'd be just this one spot of...
This is one spot.
I mean, because you know, Northern Europe is very warm in comparison to Siberia and other places. At the same...
We actually have no data from Siberia during this period of time.
No, but I mean, it's this is not a whole natural surface.
Absolutely. What we're seeing here has multiple interpretations. One of them, we're just seeing some local advection signal, and that maybe this is just a current and it's warm and happens to go by here and maybe we don't need to worry about it. Another interpretation is that these surface data that have been looked at prior to this are all diagenetically altered and have been all but pushed to the benthic values, and that we need to actually throw out most of the data that's been collected at high latitudes in the past 30 years.
Why is this data preferred to other?
There's many different reasons that one could give. One of them would be when you actually look at these forams under a microscope, you can see that they've been completely remineralized. So we know kind of a priori now that everything would point to these not being real. But we didn't know that in the past, but now we think we know that until that changes. For another reason, if you look at Schrag's work on this in the past, and work by other people. I mean, the point was always that the surface data at low latitudes might be biased to cold values, essentially because it's very strongly in disequilibrium. The bottom water is cold, the tropical waters are hot. When the foraminifera sink to the bottom of the ocean, they kind of preferentially pick up the signal of the colder, deeper waters. So people always thought about that. But they never really stopped to think, well, what if the poles were 35? Wouldn't all these same things obtain? Now there's another argument to this, which is somewhere in the world, water that has a temperature of about 10 or 11 or 12 or 13 degrees has to be forming. So this does not say that in any way that the whole polar climate was 35 degrees, just some parts of it. But it makes you stop and think, what have we been missing over the years looking at just one kind of proxy interpreted in one kind of way. This is three different proxies. They give you the same answer, and it's a completely different view of the world than we've had in the past. So this is actually going to this kind of record is going to change a lot of what we think we know.
How large of a region do those proxies cover?
Well, to tell you that, one should really look at a model. And so I've done that, and I can't get anything like this. I felt good before this data came out. I was feeling good because I finally got my model to reproduce this data. I had 5 years of my life trying to reproduce this. And then this happened.
What's the latitude?
This is 65 degrees south.
And can you just say again where the sediments are from?
So this is from, well, you mean latitude, longitude, or like what kind of setting?
Where were these samples?
So these are, for example, from Hampton Beach. So these are just, you know, you're walking along a beach and you...
In New Zealand?
In New Zealand, yes.
New Zealand's, the South Island is like 46 degrees south.
Yes.
So this is just the plate.
Paleo latitude, okay. It was between 60 and 65.
Got it.
Okay. Yeah. So this is all paleo latitude we're talking about.
And these species, so that you
extrapolating
clearly out of the present day sample of their habitats. So they're here together right now, and how do you extrapolate?
This is, so remember this, we're not, we don't actually have to do much extrapolation of anything other than the calibration of the isotope curve, or the PEX86 curve. But the calibration on those is good to, say, 30 degrees, where we actually have conditions in the world today that are 30 degrees. Well, if we go beyond 30, it's problematic. But as long as we stay kind of right around 30, we do have conditions where this sort of thing grows.
But these magnesium calcium data points, are they not specific to forum species?
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, we can
dwell someplace.
One could actually kind of change what equation one uses for the magnesium calcium. And I think actually probably what will end up happening is, if people believe PEX86, which they might not, but if they do, we'll probably end up recalibrating some of these other proxies to match. And I don't know which particular equation they use to get this. There are some choices of what equation to use and what assumption to make. I mean, I absolutely agree. This is kind of why we drew this box. If you look at the different assumptions we could make, you know, it's easily a 5-degree error, okay? But we don't think it's that kind of error, especially since we also have the delta 18O, magnesium calcium, and PEX86 that all give ballpark the same kind of numbers. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot more that will need to be done.
Could be some explosion of volcano, and then hot spot, and they measure it.
That would be tough, but I'm not going to rule it out. There is actually one of the largest volcanic episodes of Earth's history is going on locally near here for about 10 million years. And Jim Kennett had a paper in that in 1985 in Nature, talking about actually many of those same things. So, you know, hey, if you have your own idea, I think that's great.
Do something with it. When you talk about the paleo latitude,
yes,
I guess it's from a magnetic particle. So this is in comparison to the magnetic south pole. So that now new data sort of seems to show that the dynamo is pretty variable.
Yeah, that's not an issue. Yeah, there is a little bit of true polar wander, and you know that's. There are good people who work on this, that ends up not being, if you want a plus or minus 3 or 4 degrees of latitude, I think that's well within the uncertainty, but it's not like 20 degrees of latitude.
These are really short time scales compared to the dynamo variation.
Yeah. Yeah, so I agree. People should think of every single one of these points. Then you just kind of sort through them and you kind of discount them after a while. This is the thought problem as I like to think about it. These are various proxies that were available to me in about 2001. This was a simulation that was available to me in about 2001, fully coupled, doubled CO2, and it was abysmal. Extremely unhappy. For those of you who are mid-latitude dynamicists, you might say, yeah, but that I could hang a theory on. And you'd be right, I think. The mid-latitude part of the problem, I would say, is actually easily solvable. as somebody who doesn't plan on solving it, I can say that. The polar part is different. But, you know, remember, this is data as of, say, 7 years ago, and this is modeling as of, say, 7 years ago.
So you're saying the atmosphere, atmospheric circulation, and barophagic exudates is about the same in the model?
Roughly the same, yes. If I've done this, if you compare the zonal mean quantities of this simulation versus a modern-day doubled CO2 run, you would say, my gosh, they're the same. In fact, they're probably way too much the same. The cloud distribution.
Not the same as the latent heat transport, right?
The latent heat transport is minimally different at double. It increases dramatically at a certain CO2 level. Yeah. So then Paul Pearson did his Eocene pristine foraminiferal estimates and magnesium calcium, and that pumped the estimates up from 26, where they had been, up to, say, 31, and people were starting to feel pretty good, including me. I'm just doing this by hand. but let's say I tried to match these data here, and I took this same curve and I moved it up. Well, then my model, again, I did this by hand, I was just thinking. My model might predict temperatures like that, so that still wasn't good enough. And I was really worried, and I have been for years, because around 40 degrees C up in this range, for various biophysiological reasons, terrestrial plants should essentially die. And then the data people made it even worse, because the ASEX crews came out and said, yes, but temperatures aren't just, say, 12 degrees near the pole, they're actually more like 20. Oh, gosh, now my life is really difficult, because now, without having done the simulation, I was just thinking to myself, now that means I'm going to kill all plant life between 30 north and 30 south if I try to do this. And again, just with my version of a thought experiment.
What are the limits when Earth runs into Venus?
Because
we have tons of CO2.
It's, right.
It depends on solar constant, not on the CO2.
Yeah, yeah.
But Ray mentioned
it's something like 60 degrees C.
60 degrees.
Yeah.
So you're far from.
So I'm still far from there at this point.
It's
atmosphere
balance, not only carbon dioxide, it's crucial. You can't get there, but simply with carbon dioxide.
So the New Zealand data. So the New Zealand data puts you again, not on this curve, but up here, if you believe that. Again, I'm now saying that there's a chance that much of the data I was showing here before is wrong.
Just one clarification, the green diamonds in the Arctic, well, in the high latitude northern, yeah. No, the dark greens?
Oh, these.
Yeah, those points, where do they come from? Are they like the Ellesmere type points, or?
No, these would be my Ellesmere type points. These would be the Okanagan Range. These are the floral physiognomic stuff from Greenwood.
Got it. So the ASEX data really is warmer than the Ellesmere and the floral remains.
Yes. And if I was Dorian Abbott or Ellie Zipperman, I would be very happy, because if you just plot that up, now all of a sudden you get it warmer at the pole than just south of the pole. And actually they have a way of explaining why the world should look like that. Now maybe just dumb luck, because the temporal sampling is totally different. Right. But one could, if one wanted to, hang a theory on that. Various Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum temperatures are now popping up in here, so I started feeling good again. Maybe the data was... anyway. I've spent much of the past year of my life plotting up all of the data that has been published in the past 30 years on paleotemperature estimates through the whole of the Eocene, and then taking out everything that's not a pristine foram. And this is what you get. And I showed this at a meeting at Harvard last month, and I must tell you, half the people who generated these data hated me for it. I'm sorry. I'm just compiling what exists and trying to give it common calibrations. So if you look at it.
What's the problem?
Well, A, the spread is too big compared to how they like to think about things, but then I tried stratifying it according to the time interval and noticed no apparent trend. So in other words, they like to say this period was warmer and this period was colder. Actually, if you break it up into 2 million-year bins, if you have more than one data point, the spread is irreducible. I mean, I'm not to say that if we had really, really high resolution, it'd still be irreducible. But in any given location, there's going to be a 5-degree temperature change in any million-year period. So I think a lot of what people have been interpreting as trends is just random sampling of a time-varying field. So a couple of the interesting things.
You're discounting the possibility of internal variability on the order of 5 degrees within a...
No. I'm saying that's exactly what's happening.
Well, but may there be... It could be actually in the climate system.
Sure, and I actually think some of it is in the climate system and in its internal. I'm saying there is real variability, and it's on the order of 5 to 7 degrees, and it could be any number of things. We don't know what, but when you sample that kind of variability once every million years, you just get a hash that you then try and fit wiggles through.
So is the are you going to go through all the plots, but just the one on the upper right?
This?
I guess the qualitative, is there a qualitative difference in the gradient between between Barron's plot that you showed originally and this one? I mean, in the very first plot you showed, it was really flat.
Yeah. Yes.
It was extremely flat.
And so, what part of this surprise is not just the overall boost in temperatures, but how much hotter the tropics are.
Yes.
Is that
very surprising to you. You know, I'm getting tropical temperatures on the order of 40 degrees C.
Yeah.
So the gradients disappear.
And when you look at the...
Well, it didn't disappear. It's still a weak temperature gradient. It's on the order of, say, 40 going down to, say, between 15 and 20. So maybe the gradient is 20 degrees C. That actually ends up being...
It was 10.
Right, it was, yeah, it was very small.
But now you're talking about an Earth, something that's more closer to observe in the temperature gradient, or closer to modern in the temperature gradient. But how controversial
is this line I'm showing you here? This line I'm showing you here is actually a model simulation that finally, after 30 years, actually reproduces that.
You want to see a sea level of
that? Yeah, you don't want to think about that. This one is four doublings.
Four doublings.
In other words, it's 4,000 parts per million.
And that's on the same sensitivity?
Right, so my model, I can't muck with the sensitivity. So
this
what I mucked
CCSF,
with, yeah.
2 degrees.
Right, so what I did instead, rather than mucking with sensitivity, which I can't, I just mucked with CO2.
Yeah, fair enough.
And so don't think of me actually saying CO2 is 4,000. What I'm actually saying, to the degree that I'm saying anything, is that sensitivity is probably more like 4 than 2.
Right. Also, CCSM, its sensitivity has changed over the years, right? So is it very...
It's changed, and then it went back to where it was, but yes.
Oh, I see, okay. So we're still talking about a 2-degree model.
Yes.
So you're not, like, it's not extra warming on top of that.
Absolutely not, right. So, but... I'm writing a Science Perspectives article on this right now, but what I want you to think about is that this is not necessarily a hard upper limit on plant biophysics, but it could be. And if we're talking about temperatures that are like 40, people really, really, really need to think very long and hard about that.
How accepted are those really top, hot temperatures in the tropics?
They are very sensitive. I think that the data themselves are very dependable. And actually, this is at 19
you don't
degrees.
Have to say anymore, it's fine.
This is 19 degrees south.
Yeah.
It's 40.
Yes. Yeah.
This data, the ones near zero, are actually in the eastern equatorial Pacific. So that actually explains part of the temperature difference. I believe the true temperatures, if we were to measure them, are probably up in here. So this is kind of the first set of simulations, and I'm unfortunately. I'll just have to save the second half of my talk, so I'll just show the first half of my talk, which is fine. I ended up giving more of the paleoclimate side, and then apparently the hurricane side will have to wait. But this is the first set of simulations that actually starts looking like the proxies. This is a mean annual Eocene compared to a modern-day AMIP comparison to control run. This is December, January, February, where really the problem has always been, and this is compared with modern. And I finally, mean annual, have essentially the whole planet above freezing, which is a first, as far as I can tell. And if I were to plot up the data points that rule up really cold temperatures, rule out below freezing, I can now more or less have my palm trees in my crocodiles. They're not happy. They're not happy yet, but they're getting close to being happy. But what I want to point out, oh, and I can match the 37 degrees at 19 degrees south. That's not a problem. But this is what should be bothering everybody, is these bullseyes of above 40, you know, 45 degree temperatures on the land. That should bother everybody. This is an ugly plot, I'm sorry, but I'm still working on the graphics on this. This is actually from the ocean model, and I plotted up all the different sea surface temperature estimates from different data sources, and I'm doing a point-by-point comparison. And actually, I'm pretty much bang on in this simulation, except my ocean temperature here is, say, 6 to 8 degrees mean annual, and on Ellesmere Island, they would say it was 9, right? But how do I get it to 18?
But what about the ace? Is it the Ajax? Or what is the Arctic word, Asex?
Yeah, Asex.
What if they're getting like 18 to 23?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. So 9, I can get
right
there.
You can't deal
but
with
I
that.
Can't get to 18 right. In the simulation. So what happens, you know, let's take it to 11. So what happens when we try and reproduce the Asex data? Or really, I mean, if I can generalize even more, maybe to the whole Eocene, early Eocene climatic optimism. What
happened on the model side when you went from, you first tried,
the newer model is just doubling? It just looks like all the other models. Yeah. There's just not even any point in talking about low CO2 in this model.
Yeah.
So what happens at high doublings? We're now 5 doublings, over 8,000, almost 9,000 parts per million. Well, this is how the zonal mean temperature changes. Now you're seeing big numbers. This is what the difference looks like. For those of us who are dynamicists interested in water vapor, it's too bad Tapio just left. This shape is very interesting because it looks like something having to do with radiation in the changing in the radiator fins regions, 34 south. But anyway. I'm seeing, through all my other doublings, I saw about a 3 degree temperature change from doubling CO2. So from 2 doublings to 3 doublings to 4 doublings, sensitivity of about 3 degrees, which is fine. That's more or less what CCSM gets. It usually gets about 2 for kind of modern day settings. With this simulation, going from 4 doublings to 5 doublings, I get like an 8 degree temperature change. So a strongly non-constant sensitivity, which is extremely interesting. And now?
And yet, it's not that, it's the structure and latitude, I mean, there's your scale kind of exaggerates, but it's 7, 8, 9 degrees. It's not like there's a huge.
Right. It's not like it's strong.
There's no polar.
There's polar.
Supers. There's
polar amplification, but there's also tropical amplification.
Yes.
Which is odd.
Well,
that's what you're saying.
Blue might also have some feelings about that. But now, so if you have to ask, what does it take to reproduce the Asex results? This is what it takes. Now my Arctic Ocean has a mean annual temperature of 20 degrees C, and my zonal mean tropical temperatures are above 40.
What are your bottom curves showing here?
This is
the
difference.
Temperature.
This is the two curves, and this is the difference.
It's
minus what you would think. So negative values means the higher CO2 is warmer.
Okay. So that's
okay. It's red minus blue.
Sign convention was switched on you. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So this is S&P.
Yeah. And so mean annual.
So this really shows the subtropic thermosphere I was talking about.
So what causes these various things? Well, we can get into that, but essentially it's all encompassed within the greenhouse effect, downwelling, long-wave radiation, with some small change in the latent heat transport. Let me show you that.
What is the surface condition? You have current, continents, and so on, or paleo?
I have a very active ocean, very active land surface, and some of these I even have a fully dynamic vegetation scheme. Fully dynamic. Guys!
also, yeah, is that incorporated in the CO2 concentration set?
No. I'm also doing that, but this was why I was asking Inez that question, because that ends up being answer changing for all of us. But then nobody in their right mind believes a dynamic veg scheme at 10,000 ppm CO2. So what do I do, right? So this is latent heat transport. The units here are petawatts. And this is, if I'm going to try and remember this correctly, this is essentially modern day. The red line, or maybe it's doubled CO2, I can't remember. It doesn't really make a difference. This is the four doublings case, latent heat transport. The five doublings case, all hell breaks loose. And that's when you see kind of a very strongly nonlinear change in latent heat transport. Essentially, what's going on is that the vegetation on land from 30 north to 30 south dies. Evapotranspiration stops over the continents. There's a massive increase in evaporation over the oceans. And there's a switch. In case you missed.
And for the four doublings case, you showed some hot spots over land. Were those associated with dieback of vegetation?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay. So that's soil moisture.
So here's what it looks like now. This is the five doublings case. So now you see basically the whole tropics is above 40 mean annual. We're just frying everything that isn't moving.
Is there anything in the fossil record?
That's the right question, right? So interestingly, there's an absence of fossil record. for the warmest intervals. And in fact, there's a great paper that says, well, yes, people have reconstructed the vegetation of, say, the Amazon during this period, but what's notable about the reconstructions is the complete absence of data that went into them. Mm-hmm. Just so you know, people like Carlos Aramillo, when they look, they tend, during the TM in the tropics, they tend to find a big red layer.
So once you have dynamic vegetation, do they migrate? They can survive, right?
Do what?
Can they...
the rainforests, you mean?
In the high latitude?
Yeah. So during this period of time, you have rainforests in Wyoming.
Okay, I see. Okay.
So there's, in terms of, nothing about this would predict that the rainforests went extinct or anything that can be ruled out very easily.
So you do
just as they moved.
Yeah, they do migrate.
Right. And the biggest decrease in coral reef extent in the entire Cenozoic happens during, it's a low resolution record, but it happens during this interval, and the coral reef extent goes down to 0.1% of modern day. All right?
How much is precipitation change?
How much does precipitation? Not much. Global mean precipitation.
Yeah, not global mean. I mean, the
precipitation, once you get above, say, three doublings, mm-hmm. the P and E don't really change. Mm-hmm. Very much. It basically saturates out. But what does change is the spatial distribution. This is the four doublings case, this is the five doublings case. In the five doublings case, you get a permanent El Nino. This should make Alexei Fedorov very happy, except it'll probably make him very unhappy that it takes 10,000 ppm to make this happen. A huge change in precipitation, huge change in the tropical wind field, a huge change in latent heat transport. This state is associated with equatorial superrotation, so we have 20 meter per second westerly jet on the equator in this simulation. All hell's breaking loose in terms of the momentum budget in this simulation. So I will stop there in the interest of not taking 3 hours. But this was good because you guys asked the questions that you needed to ask. So what I can say is if this makes you unhappy, then, namely the death of tropical vegetation at the expense of meeting the ASEX data, then you need something that keeps the tropics cold or preferentially warms the poles. And so then I spent the past 5 years, long story short, on September 18th, 2001, I read a paper by Kerry Emanuel that, as far as I was concerned, had the potential to solve all of my problems. I emailed him. I told him I was going to devote my career for the next decade or so to work on that. And that's what I did. And we've had some success. Apparently, I will have to tell you about another time. So I'll stop there. Thanks.